This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Pierre has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in Washington State, 22 people were arrested in continuing war protests at the Port of Olympia yesterday. A prominent Ohio Republican pleaded guilty to charges he illegally funneled $45,000 to George Bush's 2004 presidential campaign. And the Prime Minister of Iraq declared a state of emergency in the Basra region.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,471 officially acknowledged deaths of U.S. soldiers. Iraq body count offered as many as 42,044 civilians and rebuilt a military intervention in Iraq. Other efforts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as 250,000 dead. And good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 31st, 2006. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Brian
Pritchett. Dozens of people protesting Iraq-bound military shipments were blasted with pepper spray, and 22 people were arrested in continuing war protests at the Port of Olympia yesterday. Two people were arrested for failure to disperse, and the rest for criminal trespass. Thurston County Sheriff Captain Bradley Watkins said protesters tore off a gate Tuesday night, entered port property, lay down, and refused to leave. For the second straight night, pepper spray was blasted at the demonstrators repeatedly, on one occasion after some protesters hurled bottles and rocks at 60 to 70 law enforcement officers from the Washington State Patrol. No one was seriously injured, and after the arrest, the number of protesters dwindled from several hundred to about 100. About three dozen held a late-night vigil, some stayed overnight, and more demonstrators arrived this morning. Most of the arrests were made shortly after the protest started, around 5 p.m., when demonstrators tore down the chain-link gate at the main port entry and confronted a line of law enforcement personnel in riot gear and helmets with face shields. As the protesters lay on the ground and linked arms, they were dragged away one by one and handcuffed as supporters yelled to let them go.
This week, the Eugene Report returns as a regular feature with producer Amy Pincus-Merwin reporting on the federal grand jury sitting in Eugene, which continues to subpoena testimony about arsons allegedly committed by the Earth Liberation Front.
This is Inform Radio, progressive news and community affairs from Eugene, Corvallis, and Southern Cascadia.
This is Amy Merwin.
Within the last couple of weeks, there was a grand jury subpoena issued to Jeff Hogue, a local activist who refused to testify before the grand jury regarding the Green Scare indictments. Here to tell us about this situation is Lauren Regan, an attorney with the Civil Liberties Defense Center.
Jeffrey Hogue, who's been a longtime Eugene resident, full-time nursing student at Lane Community College, who works with adults with autism, received a federal grand jury subpoena to appear and testify on May 18th. And based on his strong ethical position regarding non-cooperation with government investigation of social change movements, he chose to be one of the first to stand up against the government's witch hunt, as it's been labeled. He chose, rather than cooperate with the federal government regarding this ongoing harassment of the resistance movement, he made a brief statement to the media regarding the very difficult choice between his commitment to social change movements versus the fact that he knew that it was very likely that he would be taken to jail and that he would be spending his entire summer in custody regarding this grand jury subpoena.
How long can they hold him, considering his decision to not testify in front of a grand jury?
They can hold him until the end of the grand jury term, which will be over on September 30th. His lawyer will additionally file motions on his behalf, asserting that jail will not be a coercive measure in order to compel him to testify to the grand jury. Normally, a grand jury contempt person is kept in jail until either they agree to testify to the grand jury or until they are able to demonstrate to the court that putting them in jail is punitive and not coercive. There's also a slight chance that the federal government could extend the term of this grand jury. Historically, the longest that any activist has spent in custody for contempt of a grand jury proceeding is about 5 months. The purpose of a grand jury is to investigate suspects and to name new defendants. In these cases, it seems as if there just aren't really many more characters to be added to the script.
In the burning of the resort in Vail, Colorado, what's the circumstance with that most recent indictment?
The Vail indictment was issued out of Colorado. We've been expecting that each state that had an arson within its borders would be issuing their own indictment. The Oregon indictment, which alleges the conspiracy allegations, indicated that Vail was one of the incidents that they were looking at, and they certainly named some of the defendants that are now indicted in that charge in the Oregon indictment. Those individuals are innocent until proven guilty. There was also an indictment in California. There's one in Seattle, Washington. And there may be one that will come out of Wyoming as well. They're completely separate cases. For instance, they will have jury trials in Colorado separate from the trial that they will have here in Oregon. They may allege some of the same types of crimes and involve some of the same types of people, but they are distinct and separate cases.
Is this overall a broad sweep, a roundup?
The federal prosecution has been used as a distraction from other serious national issues like the warrantless wiretapping. The day that Alberto Gonzalez announced these indictments was also the day that the congressional hearings on the warrantless surveillance of American citizens began. It was also when the Valerie Plame scandal was issuing investigations of Rumsfeld, Cheney, etc. The federal government has repeatedly attempted to use distractions like this to take, especially media emphasis, away from their own illegalities and serious national issues. We do certainly believe that when the right wing began killing abortion doctors, they certainly did not have Alberto Gonzalez standing on the steps of the White House calling them terrorists. And in fact, those people received relatively minor punishment for murdering human beings and abortion doctors. And in these cases, we see that people are remaining in custody without bail. They are facing life plus 300 years for mere property damage. June 9th through the 11th is going to be the Weekend of Resistance, an annual event to bring attention to the case of Jeffrey Free Lures. This year, the focus is on the Green Scare defendants.
People can contact Inform Radio at amy@informproductions.com.
Portland radio talk show host and anti-choice activist Mary Sterrett is planning a run for governor. She told the Oregonian she'll seek the nomination of the Conservative Constitution Party, which holds a nominating convention this weekend in Lake Oswego. Sterrett could pull some key votes from Republican nominee Ron Saxton. Saxton is pro-choice, although he says he would support some limitations on the procedure, like parental notification. Sterrett hosted AM Northwest on KATU until 1997, and later had a talk show on KPDQ, a Portland-based Christian radio station. She recently helped start an anti-abortion group, Oregonians for Life, that says it will accept no compromises on the issue.
A state agency has found that abuse or neglect may be factors in 70% of the deaths in Washington's child welfare system. A report issued yesterday by the Children's Administration Ombudsman Office covers deaths of 87 children during 2004. Of those, the report found abuse and neglect may have been a factor in 61 deaths. Other officials in the agency have questioned that conclusion. The agency's Child Fatality Program Manager, Tom Stokes, says the role of neglect in a child death is often a matter of opinion. The head of the Ombudsman's office says the point is that the agency may have had a chance to prevent those deaths. She says the question is whether the agency did enough and is concerned that recommendations arising from the reviews of child deaths may not have gotten enough attention.
Governor Kulongoski and Congressman David Wu say they want to push Oregon's health records into the electronic age. At a press conference in Portland yesterday, Wu said he plans to introduce legislation to allow the National Science Foundation to award grants to universities for research and training in health information. And Kulongoski announced the appointment of a health information technology coordinator for the state. The medical community has been slow to break into the electronic age because of the cost and complication of converting such a large system. Oregon already has requested more than $26 million to get more than 4,000 doctors in the state set up to use an electronic system. The state was awarded $349,000 this week by the National Governors Association to assess the privacy and security issues that would be involved in a national electronic health system.
Governor Kulongoski says Oregon's economic recovery could be in jeopardy if voters pass the so-called Taxpayers' Bill of Rights initiative this coming fall. Last week, he was joined by Colorado business owner Christy Hargrove, who warned Oregonians not to make the same mistake that she thinks Colorado voters did. KBOO Sheila Whiteside has more.
Just don't do it. That's the warning to Oregon voters from a Colorado business owner about the proposed new Taxpayers' Bill of Rights initiative, which is commonly called TABOR. Christy Hargrove joined Governor Kulongoski Thursday to warn voters about the harm TABOR did to public education, health care, public safety, and other services in Colorado. Hargrove says TABOR just isn't what it seems.
Any benefit as a taxpayer that we received, we paid out 10 times over in having to pay for things that the state used to pay for, such as simple things like textbooks in the school. So it cost us more money, and it was like a hidden tax.
The TABOR initiative being circulated in Oregon is designed to restrict state spending by tying it to population and inflation increases. Proponents say limiting the growth of government would be good for the state economy, but last fall, Colorado voters, led by the local business community and a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers, suspended TABOR for 5 years, saying it was more damaging than helpful. Hargrove says, across the board, TABOR costs taxpayers more money in the long run.
All the things we cared about were being cut. People's priorities were being cut, like education, public health. What the state wasn't paying for, the tax burden was shifted to the local level, where everyone paid for it.
I'm Sheila Whiteside, KBOO News.
And now, for another edition of Our Backyard, with KBOO's Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, the Forest Emergency Recovery and Research Act passes in the House and now goes to the Senate. So why are so many environmental organizations and activists alarmed? I mean, recovery and research sound like good things, right? The House passed H.R. 4200, the Forest Emergency Recovery and Research Act, by a vote of 243 to 182. The bill, according to its sponsor, Oregon Congressman Greg Walden, would give federal land managers the tools necessary to restore forest land damaged by catastrophic events in quicker manner without waiving environmental laws if quick action is found to be beneficial to the long-term health and recovery of the forest. Walden describes this bill as common sense land management legislation to help restore forest health. If so, why is it being so vigorously opposed by such organizations as the Wilderness Society, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands Center, the National Wildlife Federation, and the League of Conservation Voters? And if this law will be so beneficial, then why did every other member of the Oregon Congressional Delegation vote against it? And why did another opposing group, the Eugene-based Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, write an open letter to Congress saying, this bill would make forests more flammable and increase the safety risks for wildland firefighters. In addition, it fails to address the urgent needs of rural communities for practical fuels reduction and forest restoration products before severe wildfires ignite, and diverts taxpayer resources away from critical pre-fire activities located near communities, continuing to leave communities unprepared for wildfire. And Taxpayers for Common Sense Action, a group who has successfully lobbied Congress opposing legislation that wastes taxpayer dollars, pulled no punches in their statement. They said, this legislation threatens to cost taxpayers millions by expediting the already mismanaged and wasteful Forest Service salvage sale program. Salvage sales are little more than just another handout to the logging industry, and H.R. 4200 will do little more than make these giveaways more frequent and more costly to the taxpayer. An Asheville, North Carolina Citizen Times editorial said it even more plainly.
What this bill really does is allow for the removal of dead and damaged trees without adhering to either the National Environmental Policy Act or the Endangered Species Act. So we have two opposing points of view, those who favor this legislation led by Congressman Walden and a diverse coalition of organizations and activists who oppose it. In trying to better understand this issue, I discovered the Property and Environment Research Center, or PERC, a think tank based in Bozeman, Montana, that specializes in something called free market environmentalism. According to SourceWatch, the collaborative project of the Center for Media and Democracy, this use of environmentalism in connection with the language of free market economics is now commonplace with a host of similar groups, as if it were a valid form of environmentalism rather than another tactic in the overall strategy for taking control of the public's land. PERC is linked to a long list of the country's most powerful right-wing foundations and organizations committed to deregulation of industry and to the privatization of everything. PERC's basic premise is that ownership and management of land by government is bad for the environment and that private property rights lead to better stewardship of resources. This coordinated and decades-long effort to privatize the public lands of the United States, nearly a third of the nation, is now bearing fruit. The Sagebrush Rebellion of the 1970s that sought to transfer power to states and local units and that provided the Reagan administration with James Watt as Interior Secretary morphed into the Wise Use Movement. Wise use, in turn, has given rise to so-called free market environmentalism that consists largely of a network of corporations and conservative foundations and think tanks intent on gaining control of the public domain. This collective is using all of its political clout, every legal loophole, every economic argument, and all of the public relations and media spin its billions can buy. Privatization, the word, is frequently avoided in favor of code terms such as public-private partnerships, competitive outsourcing, and stewardship contracting. And platoons of Bush appointees right out of industry are now rewriting regulations to move the privatization agenda rapidly forward. H.R. 4200 is yet another step in this process. Salvage logging, one of the most ecologically dangerous practices in modern forestry, employs an overriding short-term economic rationale as an excuse to summarily ignore all current ecological knowledge about the long-term biological sustainability of forests. According to Chris Mazur, a scientist and consultant in sustainable forest and sustainable community development, the sole object of salvage logging is to convert trees into money, thus replacing the art of forestry with the technology and economics of cutting trees. In the House, amendments to add environmental and endangered species safeguards were defeated. Now the bill moves to the Senate. Contact Senator Wyden and encourage him to oppose the Forest Emergency Recovery and Research Act. This bill, if it becomes law, will virtually prohibit public comment and is in reality yet another attempt to privatize public lands for corporate profit. And contact Senator Smith, too, even though he has already publicly praised Congressman Walden and this bill. If he hears from enough of us, who knows? He might cast his vote reflecting the will of the people rather than that of special interests. In the meantime, keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
Governor Jeb Bush of Florida has signed a law which prevents universities from spending any state funds for academic research in nations defined by the U.S. State Department as terrorist states. The policy applies to five countries currently: Sudan, North Korea, Iran, Syria, and the country which sparked the ban, Cuba. From WMNF in Tampa, KBOO alum Andrew Stelzer has more about the Cuban-American legislator who championed the law on behalf of his Cuban exile constituents despite numerous objections from the academic community.
Floridians don't want their taxpayer dollars being used to subsidize or sponsor terrorist regimes or terrorist nations, particularly in a moment when America is fighting a war on terror.
That's Miami area State Representative David Rivera, who after several unsuccessful attempts over the past few years, finally got the Travel to Terrorist States Act passed into law. Rivera was aided by the recent espionage indictment of two university employees who traveled to Cuba on academic exchange, But that travel was paid for by private funds, and Florida's academics are concerned the new policy will impede research and destroy bridges of understanding between U.S. and foreign cultures. The American Association of University Professors came out against the bill, as did the state university system chancellor and countless professors and program directors.
You cannot have a legitimate Latin American Caribbean studies program if you don't include Cuba, if students and faculty and academics are not able to travel to that place. You may as well close the doors.
Maura Barrios, a Cuban American herself, traveled to Cuba 3 times when she was the assistant director of the University of South Florida's Latin American and Caribbean Initiative.
And you may as well close the door on the university, as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to blockade the scholarly exchanges and education about a particular country, any country. And in this case, one that happens to be a part of our local history.
But Rivera disputes that he's hampering academic research opportunities.
People can still conduct research on Cuba if they want to. They can continue to write on Cuba. But if they're going to travel to Cuba, they can't be using taxpayer dollars or taxpayer resources. I believe any legitimate research activities related to terrorist nations, if they are indeed legitimate, will find private funding to pay for travel activities to those terrorist nations.
Rivera is Cuban American, and his district includes a large concentration of anti-Castro Cuban exiles, but rather than disputing the criticism that he was pleasing his base, Rivera embraces it.
I think every elected official in the country should be responsive to the wishes of their electorate. That's why they were elected, to pursue policies that their voters support. And the fact that I pursue policies that my electorate supports, I believe, makes me a better representative.
While universities can still raise private money to sponsor research trips to Cuba, Rivera says he may consider legislation to prevent that from happening during next year's session. For FSRN, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Prices for gas hit record highs in Oregon over the Memorial Day weekend. Oregon's statewide average price is up 0.9 cents since last week to $3.11 per gallon. That's well above the current national average of $2.85. Experts say consumer demand and the oncoming hurricane season are just some of the reasons that gas prices remain high. According to AAA, the statewide average price currently exceeds $3 per gallon only in 9 states and the District of Columbia. Oregon's average gasoline price is 5th highest in the nation, behind only Hawaii, California, Nevada, and Washington. Oklahoma has the lowest average price at $2.60.
As natural gas producers predict stabilized prices for the summer, a coalition of groups is calling on Congress to take action to reduce U.S. dependence on oil. With countrywide gasoline prices still high and fall elections approaching, politicians say that they will tackle the issue. However, critics say nothing substantial has been done. From Washington, D.C., we have more from Darby Hickey of Free Speech Radio News.
After 4 summers of increases in natural gas prices, producers allied with the Natural Gas Supply Association said today that they expect prices to level off this season. Natural gas is used to meet about 1/4 of the primary energy needs of the U.S., according to the Energy Information Administration. Any relief consumers might feel knowing that natural gas prices are set to stay even is likely outweighed by concerns over oil prices. But the government hasn't done enough to address that issue, the country's dependence on oil, said a coalition of groups today.
If members of Congress can't get on a bill that basically sets a goal of reducing our dependence on oil, then they are not serious about this issue.
The legislation NIAC refers to, supported by the Set America Free Coalition, which his group is a part of, is the Vehicle and Fuel Choices for American Security Act. It aims to reduce U.S. consumption of oil by 2.5 million barrels by 2016. The act is co-sponsored by a number of Democrats and Republicans in both the House and Senate, and may get more attention in the coming weeks. That's because Congress will be looking at legislation for setting fuel economy standards. A possible amendment to National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration legislation would require auto manufacturers to achieve a fleet-wide average of 33 miles per gallon in the next 10 years. Congress needs to take action on these issues, says Ann Korn of the Set America Free Coalition.
We have a bill that focuses on reducing oil dependence in a realistic way, in a way that Republicans and Democrats can agree on. Quarter of the U.S. Senate is no laughing matter, a large portion of the House. And we encourage you to include this as part of whatever legislation you're going to put on the floor on oil security. And if you don't, we're going to serve it up as an amendment.
Darren LaVos of the Natural Resources Defense Council says the Vehicle and Fuel Choices bill is critical because it addresses the issue of choice, something he says U.S. consumers lack when it comes to transportation.
Our oil dependence is hardwired into the country. Only about 700 of our tens of thousands of gas stations have a pump that offers E85, a mixture of 85% ethanol, 15% gasoline. Only a small fraction of the vehicles out there are flexibly fueled. An even smaller fraction are hybrid electric vehicles. Consumers don't have the vehicle choices and the fuel choices that they need to react to price signals that the market is sending.
All of this adds up to a significant impact on U.S. working families, says Daniel Seligman of the Apollo Alliance, a coalition of labor and environmental groups. Seligman says reducing oil dependency would benefit working people in this country.
It costs us in high prices at the fuel pump. We don't have choices for putting ethanol in our vehicles when prices spike. Second, if we were to invest in higher tech vehicles that could use ethanol, that could run on hybrid electric power, that means we would be creating tens and tens of thousands of jobs here.
One reason to push for alternative fuel sources, like ethanol and hybrid electric cars, is that the actual price of gasoline is much higher than what is listed at the pumps, says Ann Corin.
Over $8 a gallon is the real price of gasoline, if you include the security externalities, when gas is coming from the Persian Gulf. Now, if people were paying that at the pump, they would make different decisions.
What's more, much of the money spent on oil goes to fuel the other side of the war on terrorism, says Corin. That perspective is critiqued by the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, which says a better option would be pulling U.S. troops out of Afghanistan and Iraq and redirecting money spent on those wars to efforts to reduce overall energy consumption in the U.S. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Black and Hispanic children in public middle and high schools are more likely than white kids to describe profanity, truancy, fighting, weapons, and drug abuse as very serious problems. The study by the nonpartisan opinion research group Public Agenda suggests many minority kids are in what amounts to a hostile work environment. For example, 30% of black students say teachers spend more time trying to keep order in class than teaching. That's twice the percentage of white students who say that. More than half of black students say kids using profane language is a very serious problem compared to less than one-third of white students. There are similar but smaller gaps in the answers between Hispanics and whites. On the plus side, most children say they're learning a lot.
In Illinois, a white supremacist has lost another appeal of a 40-year sentence for soliciting the murder of a federal judge. A federal appeals court in Chicago upheld Matthew Hale's conviction and brushed aside Hale's claim that he repeatedly said he wanted nothing to do with the plot. The three-judge panel says Hale was just trying to, quote, create plausible deniability in case his conversation was monitored. The judges refused to reduce Hale's sentence or overturn his 2004 conviction on charges that he asked an FBI informant to murder U.S. District Judge Joan Lefkow. Lefkow had ordered Hale's white supremacist group to stop calling itself the World Church of the Creator because the name was copyrighted by another group.
In Orange County, a jury deadlocked yesterday at the trial of a 19-year-old activist who was protesting a speaking engagement by Minutemen founder Jim Gilchrist. Kimberly Mercado reports from KPFK.
Curtis Sobey was facing charges of felony assault against a police officer for allegedly using a red soda can and an object the size of a golf ball to attack police at a demonstration against the Minutemen in May of last year. However, witnesses, some of whom accompanied Sobey and up to 300 anti-Minutemen protesters at the demonstration, testified that Sobey threw no objects. Crime lab technicians testified that no fingerprints were found on the evidence. Sobey faced up to 3 years in prison if convicted on the charges. The Orange County District Attorney's Office has not determined if they will retry the case. For FSRN, I'm Kimberly Mercado, reporting from KPFK in LA.
A coin dealer and prominent Republican fundraiser pleaded guilty today to federal charges he illegally funneled about $45,000 to George W. Bush's 2004 election campaign. Tom Noe still faces charges of embezzling a $50 million investment that he managed for the Ohio State Workers' Compensation Fund. The case is important because Ohio proved a key state in Bush's retaining office amid charges that Republicans rigged the vote. The investment scandal has been a major embarrassment for Ohio's ruling Republicans and given Democrats a better shot at winning state offices this year, including the governor's office, which has been under GOP control since 1991. Investigators do not know whether No used money from the state coin fund for campaign contributions. No was charged with exceeding federal campaign contribution limits, using others to make the contributions, and causing the Bush campaign to submit a false campaign finance statement.
A military jury in Maryland is still deliberating the case of a military dog handler accused of abusing detainees in Iraq for his amusement. Sergeant Santos Cardona, based at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, was portrayed by prosecutors as part of a corrupt, sadistic conspiracy. Defense lawyers say Cardona is a victim of confusion and chaos at Abu Ghraib prison. The panel of four officers and three enlisted soldiers has deliberated now for nearly 3 hours before recessing for the night. Cardona is accused of making his dog bite one prisoner and harass another to amuse himself and other soldiers. The government also alleges Cardona competed with another dog handler to frighten detainees into soiling themselves.
The U.S. government has promised to make public all details from the inquiries into the massacre of Iraqi civilians by U.S. Marines last November. Washington made the pledge today following claims that the killings of 24 people in the town of Haditha were covered up. A White House spokesman said George W. Bush was concerned by the reports, but wanted the military to complete their inquiries first. The Pentagon is close to ending its two separate inquiries into the killings and cover-up in Haditha, including initially attributed to a clash with militants. According to the initial and now known to be false U.S. military reports, 15 civilians and 8 insurgents died after a bomb killed a Marine in Haditha in Anbar province. But the Army now says it is investigating a total of 24 deaths. Observers say the incident on November 19th could deal a more serious blow to U.S. standing in Iraq than the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandals.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6, hear Hole in the Bucket. And at 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Weather will be warm and rainy in the Willamette Valley for the rest of the week. Highs around 70 degrees. And in the Gorge, after temperatures in the mid-80s today, it will be cooling off with scattered showers for the rest of the week and highs around 70. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
At the bell, the time will be 5:32. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
For our friends in so many of the evangelical churches that have been politicized and republicanized to face up to a hard fact. You've been snookered, duped, used, had. Karl Rove, George W., and other GOP partisans wooed you hard in 2004, and sure enough, such evangelical church leaders as James Dobson poured money, endorsements, volunteers, and your own godly blessings into Republican campaigns. They put all of your political eggs into that one particular basket, putting Bush and the GOP in charge of the entire federal government. But what have you actually won? The big prize, of course, was to be a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. Even though Dobson and other church leaders had to convince you working-class evangelicals to vote against your own economic well-being, you were told that Carl, George, and the boys would be true and would deliver this social prize, so it would be worth the sacrifice. But where's George, Carl, and the GOP now? They've poured enormous political capital and energy into such issues as privatizing Social Security, cutting taxes on the rich, and pursuing their war of lies in Iraq, all of which hurts families like yours. Yet, there's been no push for the prize that was to be your reward. Bush even stopped talking about it as soon as the election was over. The naked truth is that they never meant to pursue it. Oh, sure, they're now bringing it up for a token vote, but they know it won't pass, and George W. will not even be working it, much less putting a full-court presidential press into the effort. The only reason they're even raising it at this late date is because it's another election year. They want to dupe you again. This is Jim Hightower saying, as George himself has said, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, you can't be fooled again. He's not standing for you, so why would you stand for him? Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government.
They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Iraq's prime minister declared a state of emergency today in the once peaceful and oil-rich Basra region as sectarian violence engulfing the country's capital spread to its southern economic heartland. In his first major policy speech since May 20th, when his government was sworn in, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki vowed to restore security in Iraq as attacks around the country claimed 25 lives and wounded dozens more. Al-Maliki promised to crack down on sectarian gangs in Basra and declared a month-long state of emergency, which broadens arrest powers for Iraqi security services and establishes an evening curfew. It was the only state of emergency in effect across Iraq, according to officials. Other cities where violence is rampant, such as Baghdad and Ramadi, only have curfews.
American troops killed a pregnant woman and her cousin north of Baghdad today after they didn't stop their car at a checkpoint. The U.S. military issued a statement after Iraqi police said that the two women were killed by U.S. troops as they were driving to a maternity hospital in Samarra, roughly 60 miles north of Baghdad. The U.S. military statement says the car entered a clearly marked prohibited area near coalition troops and that, quote, shots were fired to disable the vehicle, end quote, after it apparently failed to stop despite repeated signals.
Iran does not pose an immediate nuclear threat, and the world must act cautiously to avoid repeating mistakes made with Iraq and North Korea, the head of the United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency said yesterday. Mohammed Al-Baradei, director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said the world shouldn't jump the gun with erroneous information, as he said the U.S.-led coalition did in Iraq in 2003, nor should it push the country into retaliation as international sanctions did in North Korea. The recent violent history in Iraq bears an important lesson for diplomacy with neighboring Iran, the diplomat said. The Bush administration led a coalition into Iraq in 2003, saying President Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction. No such weapons were ever found. Quote, I ask myself every day if that's the way we want to go in getting rid of every single dictator, Al-Baradei said. While it was unclear whether Iran ultimately intended to redirect its development of nuclear power into a weapons program, it was clear there was no danger of that right now, Al-Baradei said.
Police in Berlin, Germany, say they have foiled a German woman's plans to travel abroad and become a suicide bomber. She is one of three women being investigated after announcing plans on the internet to carry out missions in Iraq. Berlin police say the woman may have been planning to take along her child. Last year, a Belgian woman who converted to Islam blew herself up in Baghdad, killing six people. Berlin police told the BBC they had discovered that a 40-year-old woman was planning via an internet forum to commit suicide, kill, or injure people abroad.
The United Nations Conference on Global HIV/AIDS kicked off today in New York with the release of a new report that indicates more has been done in the last 5 years to counter the spread of and to treat people with HIV. But the report also states that the goals set up by the United Nations 5 years ago are far from being achieved. The report also indicates that women make up the majority of people living with HIV/AIDS. Mitch Jesserich has more.
Just a week before the 25th anniversary of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, the United Nations kicked off its global HIV/AIDS conference to examine its call back in 2001 to fight the disease and the devastating effects that it has had on communities worldwide. A new UN report released to coincide with the conference suggests that the spread of AIDS has slowed, with a decline in new infections in 10 countries, including Haiti, Kenya, and Zimbabwe. However, in other countries, the rate of infection continues to rise. UN General Secretary Kofi Annan addressed the General Assembly in the opening of the conference.
A significant number of countries have managed to reach key objectives. More than 70 have quadrupled access to HIV testing and counseling services. More than 20 have reached the goal of 3x5 initiative, providing antiretroviral treatment to at least half of those in need. Yet, the vast majority of countries have fallen distressingly short of meeting the targets in the declaration.
The report shows that women now make up the majority of people living with HIV/AIDS in the world. This number is over two-thirds throughout some countries in Africa. 29-year-old Kansani Mabasa, South Africa, which has the highest rate of infections, became the first person living with HIV/AIDS to address the UN General Assembly today. She wore a white T-shirt that read HIV positive as she spoke.
I call on African leaders sitting here to protect and promote the human rights of all people and vulnerable groups, particularly women and girls. We ask that you not fail us yet again.
FSRN caught up with Kansani Mavasa at a rally across the street from the United Nations.
There are still a lot of things that are not happening. And more especially when we look at the issues of the people who are facing the vulnerability. They are not accessing the treatment, as it was said. They are not accessing the prevention. I can give an example like the issue of condoms, where we are talking of male and female condoms. When we go to in practical where the people need this access, they are not getting it. And when we look at the factors, these factors are known to our government, that due to the lack of money, due to distances where people are not accessing clinics, these are the problem, which means that when we go to the resources, they should go to the people who need them, but people are not affording them because of all those kind of target issues. They are not responded accordingly.
India also has one of the highest numbers of people living with HIV/AIDS. Dr. Vanita Gupta is with the Stop HIV/AIDS in India. She joined the hundreds of people from around the world who demonstrated today outside of the UN.
They are not even fulfilling the promises the governments made in 2001. And the mere basic promises that they themselves made. So we are here to ask for fulfillment of the commitment.
What are those promises?
Some of the promises, I would focus on India. Some of the promises were that they would decrease the prevalence of HIV/AIDS. And in India, there has been increase of 32%. And they said they would cover the women, 5 million women, for prevalence and counseling by 2005. And it's less than 3% who are getting any kind of prophylaxis.
The UN Conference on AIDS will continue until the end of the week. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezrich in New York.
The number of Guantanamo Bay detainees conducting a hunger strike has ballooned from 3 to about 75, the U.S. military said Monday, revealing growing defiance among prisoners held for up to 4.5 years. Navy Commander Robert Durand called the hunger strike at the U.S. naval base in southeastern Cuba an attention-getting tactic to step up pressure for the inmates' release, and said it might be related to a May 18th clash between detainees and guards that injured 6. The U.S. holds about 460 people at Guantanamo Bay on suspicion of links to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. But human rights groups say innocent people have been sent to the prison. Defense lawyers said the hunger strike, which began last year, reflected increasing frustration among men who have had little contact with the world outside the remote prison.
The death toll from Saturday's earthquake in Indonesia is now approaching 6,000. Government officials say that more than 105,000 homes have been destroyed. The magnitude 6.3 quake turned homes into piles of bricks, tiles, wood in less than a minute. As many victims slept or were preparing breakfast. Survivors complained in the days after the earthquake that aid was slow in coming. Thousands of women and children are lining the roads in the hardest-hit district of Bantul begging for money. But the top humanitarian official at the United Nations says the crisis appears to be easing, with more victims getting aid. Jan Egeland says more than 20 countries have joined the rescue effort, and there is better coordination among aid organizations. For example, hospital parking lots and hallways that were filled with hundreds of injured in the days after the quake are now clear, with most patients being treated in beds.
In Oregon, aid to Indonesia earthquake victims is being organized by Mercy Corps. KBOO Spencer Raymond has more.
Oregonians are quickly stepping up to help the 150,000 people left homeless after this weekend's earthquake on the Indonesian island of Java. The Oregon-based humanitarian aid group Mercy Corps already has a team on the ground distributing emergency kits to survivors. Spokesman Jerry Barnacle says they're hurrying to help with immediate needs.
One of the really acute needs right now is for temporary shelter. We're sending out survival kits, which includes a tarp, some blankets, and some hygiene products for families before we can find more permanent housing for them.
Barnacle says they will expand their response to help clean up and rebuild as soon as the immediate survival needs are met. Over 5,000 people were killed in the quake, and the toll is expected to rise. Barnacle also says they are looking at what it will take to get the communities back on their feet.
How do you get kids back in school? How do you get people moving back into homes? How do you get markets functioning again? And even as we're giving direct relief, we're looking at the longer-term needs.
Mercy Corps, with its global headquarters in Portland, employs more than 2,500 people worldwide who help nearly 10 million people in more than 40 countries. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
High school students throughout Chile staged the largest nationwide walkout in 3 decades yesterday. High school students began demonstrations in April after marathon meetings failed to produce any results on the students' demands for improved access to education and bus passes. They then changed tactics by staging sit-ins, lectures, and virtually shutting down public high schools in Chile's main cities for the last 10 days. These are the first student protests during Chilean President Michelle Bachelet's terms and for the country's new Minister of Education. FSRN's Jorge Garaton reports from Santiago.
600,000 high school students took to the streets throughout Chile in the largest demonstration yet since they began protesting for a better public education system over a month ago. The student demonstrations came just a month after the new government took office last March. But the demonstration was marred in Santiago by the violent action of police that broke up marches, sit-ins, peaceful gatherings of students in public places. The police even beat up journalists, sending 4 of them to hospital. While the students marched, their leaders met with the Minister of Education. After the meeting, high school student spokesperson Maximiliano Mellado described what happened at the meeting.
The meeting had 2 objectives. First, we worked on short-term demands. On Wednesday, we will discuss the long-term demands, like changes to the school curriculum and changes in the education legislation. In this meeting, we talked about school nutrition programs, student bus pass, and student fares.
The students are demanding free bus fare, a national bus pass, free university entrance exam fee, reform to the school curriculum, and the reform to the Education Act. The Education Act is a constitutional piece of legislation passed by the Pinochet regime hours before the return to democratic rule that transforms the educational system into a tradable commodity. The public system was dumped onto the municipal government, but funded by the central government. There are also publicly funded private schools that give any person the right to open a private school as a public-private partnership with government vouchers that pay for each student, which sucks funds from the strained public school system. Also, private schools discriminate on the students' stakes, dumping the so-called children from working families into the underfunded public system. Minister of Education Martin Selich says he was pleased with the first round of meetings.
This has been a great democratic exercise. We are moving forward and are happy. We will continue meeting Wednesday. I will not break the agreement I made with the students to not discuss in public what we talked about until an agreement is reached.
Student spokesperson Maria Jesus Sanhueza says the students' assembly will know first what was discussed.
We had 600,000 students in the streets, and they are pushing for our demands. They put forward the 5-point program. So we speak for them, but they will decide what demands will be given priority in the negotiations with the ministry.
But what stood out was not only the resolve of the students and their organizational capacity, but the heavy-handed action of the police. A student leader, Karina Delfino, called it a disgrace.
It is shameful how the police acted. It is shameful how they treated us as students and how they beat up journalists. We cannot accept that people are hurt in a protest that began without incidents. Police used extreme violence.
The meetings will continue until an agreement is reached. In Congress, legislators of all stripes say they are prepared to change the Education Act by giving the needed quorum. But before it reaches Congress, any deal must be approved by the students. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garreton in Santiago.
2 days of calm in East Timor's capital, Dili, was broken today, with peacekeepers unable to quell continued fighting by groups of youths wielding machetes. This follows days of unrest and fighting sparked by a rebellion led by sacked members of the East Timor Armed Forces. FSRN's Erica Vowles reports that despite the presence of peacekeeping forces from Australia, New Zealand, and Malaysia, the capital and the country remains tense.
Despite its leaders reaching a political solution to end days of fighting that have rocked the country and led to 27 deaths, no one is breathing easy in the world's newest nation. The sacking of 594 members of the country's army sparked a rebellion, prompting East Timor's government last week to call on its neighbour Australia and the United Nations to provide peacekeepers to restore order. Despite concerns of a backlash because Prime Minister Mariel Katiri was not actually removed from office, Dili-based human rights lawyer Adarito de Jesus Soares says the capital is much calmer since President Jenar Gusmao has taken control of the military and declared a state of emergency.
Well, I do hope, and I think that's the general feeling of the population, that things will come down. And with the role that played by President at the moment, I think it's very, very important. And it's kind of, you know, give kind of confidence to people again that, you know, at least some of the institution is in functioning at the moment.
The Western world, particularly the Australian government, has largely laid the blame at the feet of Prime Minister Mariel Katiri for not handling the unrest within the armed forces better. However, Serena Killam, an Australian NGO worker who has lived and worked in East Timor for the past 5 years, believes it's unfair to lay all the blame on Al Katiri.
I don't think it's fair to say that this is Al Katiri's fault. You could say it is the government leadership's fault and the leadership of the country, but that therefore includes the President and the Minister for Defence and the Minister for the Interior and multiple other ministers. In terms of the problems from within the military before that with the petitioners, it's a new government. The government, you know, it's not even 4 years old, and they just haven't had the skills or haven't reacted appropriately to the situation.
It's been beyond the comprehension of many that the members of the military that have been fighting against each other previously fought side by side against the Indonesians. This culminated in a gun battle last week where several members of the police force were shot dead by the military, despite a UN-bartered ceasefire. East Timor expert from Deakin University, Damien Kingsbury, says perceptions that many from the western districts of East Timor sided with the Indonesians under the occupation have kept them divided from their eastern counterparts, who feel they bore the brunt of the 24-year occupation.
There's no doubt that most of the police were recruited from the Western districts, and there's no doubt that the Western command of the East Timor Defence Force felt discriminated against. That's why they went on strike and were sacked ultimately, and that then led to the riot and the recent conflict. But the division is much less around ethnicity than it is around probably geographic location, and the perception the people from the West are closer to West Timor and hence Indonesia, and were closer to the Indonesians during the period of the occupation.
Many have also been dismayed by the total breakdown in law and order that has occurred in the past week, with the capital being ransacked by looting perpetuated by machete-wielding youths. Damien Kingsbury sees this as a legacy of colonial rule.
There's no question that the institutions of rule of law are not well established. That is directly a consequence of their experience, particularly under the Indonesians, but also under the colonial Portuguese. So really those sorts of values haven't yet taken root in East Timorese society, and there's still a very strong tendency, unfortunately, to want to take law into their own hands.
While calm may have been temporarily restored, there are still 40,000 refugees living in makeshift camps around Dili alone, and they will most likely not return home anytime soon, making a humanitarian crisis a very real prospect. This is Erica Voles in Sydney, reporting for FSRN.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 31st, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Tonight's news service editors are Jasonia Watson and Eve Sokolai. Special thanks to reporters Doug Guidi, Sheila Whiteside, Edison Carter, and Spencer Raymond. Our engineer is Jim Thompson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Andrew Geller. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up in the morning at 7 a.m., tune in for the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 on Voices of from the Edge Talk Radio, Joanne and Dave speak with Portland writer and researcher Christian Williams, author of American Methods, Torture, and the Logic of Domination. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, at its new time every Thursday at 9 a.m. At 9:30, hear an interview with artist and writer Ann Fessler, author of The Girls Who Went Away, the hidden story of women who surrendered children for adoption in the decades before Roe v. Wade. At 10, hear The Recovery Zone with Stephanie Potter and her guest, spiritual ecologist Morgan Brent. They'll discuss his work on Earth consciousness. At 10:30, Julie Bernard hosts Art Focus, and at 11, it's Democracy Now! All of that is right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio station. Thank you very much for joining us.
Striking doctors and medical students call off their strike this afternoon. Striking doctors.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, the 31st of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A tribe in Nevada is trying to come up with solutions to combat the growing methamphetamine epidemic in the state. But as Mike Clifford reports, the closure of a treatment center will make the problem that much tougher to deal with.
Vicki Lilligard, a family advocate with the Reno Sparks Indian Colony Prevention Coalition, says it's very troubling. At the very time the need for meth treatment is greatest in Nevada, the only inpatient adolescent substance abuse treatment center in Washoe County is going to close its doors in 30 days due to lack of funding.
A lot of times people might change their mind. They might be ready now for whatever reason, and, you know, a month from now they might be, you know, using still and doing things and just not ready to go to treatment when their bed becomes available.
Lilligard says the loss of the adolescent treatment center in their county is simply going to put more stress on the rest of the state because all of Nevada's treatment centers already have long waiting lists. This is Mike Clifford.
A national organization that focuses on returning Native remains and cultural items to tribal groups is meeting this week in Juneau, Alaska. The Federal Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Review Committee helps determine the tribal identity of cultural items in museums and helps resolve disputes under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990. The act set up a process for museums and government agencies to return human remains, sacred objects, and other items to tribal groups. NAGPRA staffer Tim McEwen says one agenda item up for discussion is the disposal of culturally unidentifiable human remains from Iowa.
There's no specific remains that they're focusing on. They're actually looking at a plan that would help implement the disposition of unidentifiable remains found in Iowa in the future. So they're basically trying to coordinate state law and federal law on this issue.
The panel is also hearing about a possible dispute between the White Mountain Apache of Arizona and the Field Museum of Chicago.
The Field Museum has in its collection a number of items related to the Gan ceremony, which is sort of masked figures that personate gods as part of their religious practice that the Field Museum had acquired over the last century. And the White Mountain Apache believe that those are so-called objects of cultural patrimony, that is, they're communally owned and that no one had the right to alienate them. And the Field Museum has countered that they believe that they have right of possession, which that they acquired them fair and square.
This is the panel's 32nd meeting since it was formed in 1992. The meeting is being held in conjunction with Celebration 06, a Southeast Alaska Native cultural event which begins today. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has details on the celebration.
About 45 dance groups with about 2,000 participants will take the stage and parade through the streets of Juneau during this year's celebration. It's the latest in a series of events that began in 1982 with a dozen dance groups and 150 people. Celebration is organized by the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and its coordinator is Bob Hamilton.
The idea was to bring together the three tribal groups, Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian in Southeast, and to start celebrating their respective cultures. And that's just carried on a biannual basis.
This year's theme is reflections of our ancestors in the faces of our children, and the dancers from Southeast, Anchorage, the Yukon, British Columbia, and Washington State include elders as well as school groups. Celebration begins with a traditional canoe welcoming ceremony and ends with canoe races. In between, in addition to the dancing, is a Native artists' market, a prepared black seaweed competition, and lectures by artists. There's also Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian language workshops and a baby regalia review. Coverage will also be streamed live on the Internet through the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's website. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ameren Risk Management Corporation, a multi-regional, multi-tribal federal corporation serving Indian country.